When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, welcome to another Between Season mini episode of Origin Story. This one going out to all our listeners. There are also exclusive ones for Patreons only in the weeks in between. I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I am Ian Dunt.
This time it's another bit of shameless self-promotion. I promoted my new book and Ian's book, his Sunday Times bestseller, How Westminster Works and Why It Doesn't. It's out now in paperback, and there's origin story material in there. Ian, what are you going to be storying the origin of?
Yeah, it's tenuous, but doable editorially, and that's all that I require it to be for this purpose. And it's the origin of Downing Street. I feel, you know, in the last, your bit of book promotion, you sort of took us really from sort of the dawn of the biblical age of disaster straight through to the start of the age of the secular apocalypse. And on that basis, I feel slightly, you know, intellectually emasculated, really, by reducing it to, I'm going to talk about a house in London, a townhouse in London.
Listen, man, if that's what it takes to get a Sunday Times bestseller, I'm all for it. Right, so it's like the house itself.
The house itself, and really how the house is fucking us. Because that use of that house has just been a complete disaster for so long in how we organise things in this country. And yet, because we are this country and because we operate according to an almost pathological sense of sentimentality, we're unable to think, well, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't put the government in a house. Maybe that just doesn't make sense as an idea, and government should have proper buildings where they can function properly.
Are you talking about changing things, Ian?
Exactly. I'm talking about not basing everything you're going to do in future on the random fetish for precedent about what happened in the past, that maybe we could actually think, you know, what's a rational way of organising the country. But I don't want to be too radical right now.
That sounds a bit Marxist. You want to replace it with a Soviet-style concrete block called the Power Bureau.
Exactly. We'll put number 10 in the Trellick Tower and see how it all works out.
So take us back.
It's marshland. It's marshland up until 1682.
Is this a political metaphor?
Yes. You know what? In a moment, there's going to be a quote that when I put it in the book, I thought, it's just too on the nose as an architectural metaphor that I need to point that out before I introduce the quote. So marshland up until 1682, the marshland is bought by George Downing, whose name you might recognise. Now, this guy is like an absolute rascal scumbag. Nobody likes him. Like, even his own mother calls him a penny pincher.
Okay.
Samuel Pepys calls him a perfidious rogue. Churchill, 300 years later, calls him a profiteering contractor. Like, nobody approves. He works for Cromwell during the Republican experiment in England. Then he switches to Charles II. He starts sort of trying to track down his old allies and basically sending them to be killed, and is eventually put in the Tower of London for cowardice. He is despised by
history. He sounds quite cancellable.
He's extremely cancellable, yeah. He's a very, very flawed human being who bought a very flawed piece of land and built a very flawed house upon it. A series of houses built between 1682 and 1684. That's stage one. That's the building of Downing Street. Stage two comes about 50 years later, when it becomes kind of politicised as a building. And the moment it becomes politicised is 1732. George II sits down and goes, well, I'm going to give you this house. And the person he's going to give it to is the First Lord of the Treasury, or the Prime Minister, who's Robert Walpole. Robert Walpole says, I'll take the house, but I don't want you to give it to me personally. I want you to give it to me in my political capacity. And the reason he does that is almost certainly because he doesn't want to spend his own money doing it up. He wants tax money to be able to do it. And on this basis, it has become what it is right now. So he gets his guy in. His guy is William Kent. It's his architect. And just says, go to work on it, please.
Like Carrie Johnson.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yes.
With the wallpaper.
Indeed. Yes. In a way, he's like an ancient Carrie Johnson. They join the house. There's a much bigger house at its rear. They join that. There's a small cottage to the side. They join that. So they start just sticking all these bits of building to make it a bit larger. And William Kent just guts the interiors and joins all these properties together using the staircase as the centerpiece. The staircase you may recognize from important constitutional products like Love Actually. It's that moment where, you know, you have the portraits of all the prime ministers going all the way down. Apparently, I'm told this, a red flag on it, because I haven't actually vouchsafed this, but I'm told that when they put in a new portrait of a prime minister, they have to move all the other ones down. And I kept on having that thought on, like, the very end of Liz Truss's tenure, that there's just some bloke on that staircase who's just finished moving all of the belongings. Just like, for fuck's sake, you cannot do this to me right now. So here is the quote that needed kind of a little bit of justification before I used it, because it's just too on the nose. It's by historian R.J. Minney about the changes that William Kent and Walpole made. The money had been spent lavishly. A delightful home, spacious and decorated with taste, had been provided for the King's First Minister. But neither Kent nor Downing had given much thought to the foundations. It was inevitable that the timber would rot and that the house would be in need of constant and costly attention. And so it is. It's basically architecturally unsound. But also, it is, needless to say, constitutionally unsound for us to be basing government in this rotting old house. Stage three comes when we decide that prime ministers need to stay there all the time. Before this, no one ever thought a prime minister actually needs to live there. It just happened to be a residence that was given to the First Lord of the Admiralty.
Right.
And in fact, prime ministers don't really want to stay there for the next few decades, because the whole area, in much the same way as now, you know, was just a din of iniquity. It was basically gym parlours and brothels were typified that part of town. So they mostly stay away. Arthur Balfour, who we've come across before in our Iron Ends an episode, is the first prime minister to sort of take proper residence there. The reason that he does so is just because he happens to be staying there when he's the leader of the Commons. That's just where he's staying. Then they make him prime minister and he's like, okay, well, I'll keep on staying here. And again, just because of the completely inane manner in which we think about how we organise ourselves, someone decided, oh, that's just a thing now. So all the prime ministers need to stay there from this point on. And that's when that takes place, 1902. And then there's a fourth stage, which is much less discussed, but I think probably more important, because it's the point where the house starts to own us rather than the other way around. And it's in 1963. There's a big redevelopment of the house. This is during when Harold Macmillan's in there. And for the first point, a complete redesign is possible. You could at that stage go, okay, what are we going to do with this place to make it function for modern government? And they don't do that. There's a debate about it. They don't. Conservationism wins the day completely. And from that point, you've kind of made your bed, your British bed. You know, you've decided what kind of country you want to be.
But why? Oh, my God, though. But isn't that so British that conservationism would take priority over the needs of functioning government? Like, its main job is to be the Prime Minister's base of operations. It is not to be like a cool old building built on marshland by a scoundrel. Like, I don't really see, know, like, why you would not go for pragmatism there. And Macmillan was, although he was a fairly pragmatic fellow.
Yeah, he was. In fact, that's basically the first word you would probably use about him in any kind of assessment. But nevertheless, that's how it goes. Robert Armstrong, who's principal private secretary for Edward Heath and Harold Wilson, kind of summarized it, I think. He said, "I'm sure that if you were starting from fresh, you wouldn't start with number 10. But you aren't starting afresh. I think a conscious decision has been made, and made repeatedly, that the right thing to do is to preserve number 10 in its 18th century form and live with that." And that is exactly what we have done. So let me give you the layout of how it operates. You've got the cabinet room. That's the only room of any significant amount of size in the whole of the building. But you don't really get the sense of size because there's a giant fuck-off table, you know, all the way through the middle of it. So you can't really do anything there. You've got four rooms off to the side. On one side, there's two, and on the other side, there's two. So on one side, you've got the senior private secretaries and the junior private secretaries in those rooms. Private secretaries are basically the top of the civil service hierarchy in Downing Street. They'd be covering particular areas: education, health, transport, home. And they're meant to be in communication with the departments for that particular topic area and back and forth, part of the interconnecting sort of communication structure. The other side, you've got another two rooms. Those are usually occupied by political advisors. You go up the stairs and you get to the wiggery.
I've literally never heard of this word.
For listeners, Dorian Linsky is frowning quite significantly at the word
wiggery. I've literally never heard of this rather inelegant word.
It's basically a wardrobe. It's a wardrobe. But it's turned into these kind of working cubby holes. And over the years, it's been used by all sorts of people. Assistant private secretaries, press secretaries, policy advisors, chiefs of staff. That some of the most senior positions in British politics work in a formal wardrobe. You go up the stairs again to a study. Mm-hmm. The study is often used by various prime ministers. You go up a few more offices and you go up after that and you get to the flat where most prime ministers live, unless they've got young children, in which case they tend to take the flat above number 11. They take
the
chance
for that. That's what Blair did, right?
Exactly. Any prime minister with young children will tend to go over to next door because it's just got a bit more space to it. Their working arrangements, prime ministers, kind of are defined really by... Almost their personality tells you which room they're likely to work in historically. Mm. So the more informal ones will tend to work, informal being a relative term when it comes to prime ministers, will tend to work in that study, that second floor study. So that's where Harold Wilson worked. It's where Ted Heath worked. It's where Margaret Thatcher worked. It's now called the Margaret Thatcher room, actually. Gordon Brown put a big portrait of her in that room for reasons that only he can possibly understand.
Wow.
The cabinet room was the room that the more formal prime ministers would like to work in. It's the room where you're supposed to be working.
God, can you imagine? I'm just trying to imagine if Jeremy Corbyn had become prime minister. Like, how long would that portrait of Margaret Thatcher have lasted? How many minutes?
It would have been one of the more commendable acts of vandalism that he would have done. So Clement Attlee worked in the cabinet room. Anthony Eden worked there. John Major worked there. Usually they're the ones that want to work around the cabinet more. They want a more formal structure. Things changed a bit when Blair came in. Blair came in and went, well, you know what? I'm going to take one of those rooms just off the cabinet room. That seems better. And he set up operations there, Blair's den. But it was just embarrassing because every time, you know, a foreign leader came, you'd have the US president there. You'd have the president of France come in. And you're just in this kind of dark, damp, tiny room off the cabinet. And there was a point where, you know, even at that stage, we were just like, this cannot go on. This is just a preposterous circumstance we found ourselves in. So Blair then moved over to the private secretary's room, to the senior private secretary's room, turfed them out. They turfed out the junior private secretaries, and they just went upstairs. So basically, this completely uncoordinated shifting around of purposes and of communication systems on the basis of just trying to find a suitable place for a prime minister to use for his work.
It's just wild when you think the White House, also famously built on a swamp, you know, does seem pretty incredible. If you're going to meet the president at the White House, you know, you could sleep in the Lincoln bedroom, you know, the visit the Oval Office. Like... It, again, is an old building with a lot of heritage built on swamp, but it's a fairly spectacular building.
Yes.
Downing Street doesn't sound... I've never visited for weird reason.
Anytime now, though, I'm going to send you the invite.
Oh, yeah, no, I think I'm first on Starmer's list just to check it out. But I mean, it doesn't sound like if you are a visiting dignitary that it's a particularly thrilling place to be.
No, but then what they want is, and I think the reason that we keep it is they want the photo by the front door.
They love coming out, don't they?
They love the door.
It's like
the
Rishi
door.
Sunak loves the press conferences in front of the door.
Exactly. The honest truth is it's got nothing to do with the building. It's just the door. The door is a very famous door. It is arguably the most famous door in the world. And on that basis of wanting to keep it, and probably thinking when a foreign dignitary comes, that they use that as part of their kind of portfolio of imagery to show their statesmanlike credentials.
Yes.
You know, they think, well, we'll keep it because that's what we want to use it for. You can do all of that while not working in the fucking building.
Well,
you know,
yeah, that's why the Chancellor holds up the red box.
Right, right, yeah.
And Downing Street, these doors, I mean, there's number 11 as well, but these doors are really important. That's where people go in and out for the reshuffle.
So I thought you were going to go into a defence of doors in general. Where would we be without doors?
No, listen,
we wouldn't be able to access rooms.
No, we wouldn't. It would just be awful. We'd all just be stuck in rooms. No, but these particular doors, like they are kind of burned into the brain of anybody with the faintest interest in British politics.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's ultimately what it's all about. It's just about that image. Blair stayed in that room, that senior private secretary's room. And actually, that's become the kind of default room for prime ministers. So Theresa May used it. Boris Johnson used it. That's kind of become the least worst option for somewhere for the prime minister to work.
Right.
They have other offices. They have an office in Parliament. You know, obviously, they have Chequers, which is the big country sort of estate.
Mm.
But that's where they work when they're in Downing Street. no one has ever been able to make administration work in that building. Like one of the most consistent views you find when you talk to people that have worked at the height of government, particularly officials rather than politicians, is you can't make it work. You just can't work in there. So, I mean, here's a selection of quotes. This is Marsha Williams, Wilson's personal and political secretary. Its designers have not succeeded in making it either an efficient office or a comfortable home. It seems to exude an air of condescending contempt for both roles.
It's a metaphor for Britain.
It's actually quite hard to get away from the metaphor. Yeah, yeah. Douglas Hurd, who was Heath's political secretary, said, it's hard to imagine anyone governing anything substantial from number 10. Jonathan Powell, Blair's chief of staff, said it was, quote, extraordinarily ill-suited to be the headquarters of a modern government. And almost every administration, they come in and the chief of staff type role, it could be different people, but that sort of person that's usually unelected and contributing, usually tries to get the prime minister the fuck out of the building. They sit there and one of the first realizations is we obviously can't make this work in here. We don't have enough meeting rooms. We can't get whole teams in one place. You're going to have teams that are working on three different floors across four different rooms. We don't have the communication. We've had to put most of our staff all the way over there in the cabinet office, basically on the other side of Whitehall. There's like at the minimum, a 5-minute walk from where we are now. We don't have breakout rooms. We just can't run anything above the size of a medium-sized town from this house. So what are we going to do to change it? And they keep on trying. I mean, Powell tries twice with Blair to go, let's just move to the Queen Elizabeth Conference Centre. It's just down the road. We could do it there. And he's like, it gets nixed both times. Gordon Brown is actually convinced temporarily to move things to this kind of horseshoe working brain centre for government in number 12 on Downing Street. And that experiment actually lasts for a while until Cameron comes in and goes, we're going to get rid of that now. We're not going to do it.
Can I ask, because I actually have no idea, what else is there on Downing Street? Like, presumably there's not just like number 8 isn't just like some family.
You're like, fucking hell, how do we get home?
Going, oh, this is really busy. It's really busy. We should move. Is the entirety of Downing Street consist of government offices?
I'm unaware, and I want to red flag this. I'm unaware of anything that isn't government on Downing Street.
It would make sense, because it'd be quite weird if every time you went to the shops, you just have to come back through like the gates and the dogs and the guns.
It would be a very strange living arrangement.
Can you imagine trying to have a party there?
You would feel simultaneously quite secure, but also not particularly safe.
Yeah.
Cummings, to his credit, tries. I mean, because he's Dominic Cummings, he comes up with this sort of, you know, international space station already, you know, that he wants to set up in 70 Whitehall. But honestly, you speak to people that were involved in that, they're like, yeah, it wasn't bad. Like, we actually were able to, you know, commute. We had like, you know, legislative affairs programs that sat with the policy unit. There was, you know, it was much easier for us to talk in that room than it was all based in Downing Street. But he, you know, leaves with his tiny box and his resentments, and his experiment leaves with him. Basically, it dies there. And that's where we are right now. No one has succeeded in getting them out. Now, what I want to talk about is what it does to government to base it in that townhouse. And the main thing it does is just completely fucks them up. It creates this chaotic, emperor-like structure, extremely primitive in its organizational sort of rules. The primary rule, and this is the rule for administrations, regardless of their political character, regardless of the personalities involved in them, regardless of the time period, the primary rule is face time. And it's that your seniority in the building is defined by the amount of face time you get with the prime minister.
Okay.
So then that's it. All the other kind of tokens of seniority that we have, the size of your office, the amount of light it gets, you know, the quality of the decoration, all of them go. All anyone cares about is how close can I get, literally, physically, to the prime minister? Here's Andrew Adonis, who was the head of Number 10 Policy Unit for Blair. I very rapidly gave up my big office to someone much more junior and moved downstairs into this tiny cubbyhole, so small that you could barely get a desk and a chair in. I could only have a visitor if they stood, but I chose to have that room because it put me right next to the Prime Minister. I would rather have a tiny cubbyhole than a room 10 times the size, a few more metres away. And this remorseless crushing in around the PM is basically exactly how anyone describes working in Downing Street for any administration whatsoever. The only other criteria that they ever mention is the gatekeeper criteria, the ability to be close to the prime minister and in a position so that you can block off other people accessing them. Mm. And here's Gavin Barwell, who does, he's got a book called Chief of Staff. He was Chief of Staff to Theresa May. It's mostly a work of speculative fiction to imagine what if Theresa May's administration was the work of really rational, moderate liberals, rather than the kind of spasm of degenerate reactionary horror that we actually witnessed in the real world. Gavin Barwell says this. I quite like Gavin Barwell now, by the way, but I have to say that book, it has more in common with fiction than it does with reality. Right. My desk was immediately outside the door of the Prime Minister's office. This had one big advantage. It made me a literal gatekeeper. Provided I was at my post, no one could pop in to see the Prime Minister without me knowing it. And that's it. These are the rules. FaceTime, gatekeeping. Be as close as you can get to the Prime Minister. Be in a position where you can block other people's access to them.
It doesn't seem very psychologically healthy being Prime Minister or being around a Prime Minister.
No, it doesn't.
Like, it sounds quite awful. Like, if every time, can you just imagine, every time you looked up, there'd be like Andrew Adonis or Gavin Barwell just staring at you. Giving you a little thumbs up.
It would be, I would have restless nights full of anxiety dreams.
Do they ever woke up? Like, just Blair just sort of woke up in the middle of the night and then there's Andrew Adonis sitting in just a chair next to the bed. Like, I don't know. It seems really just like a destructive way to... Yeah, to live.
Exactly. And there's no normality to it at all. I mean, there's no sense of, you know, when you just have meetings and emails and a normal working environment. No, it's based around this insane macho emperor-like structure, just extremely primitive. Oh. So what it tends to encourage is a form of professionalized loitering, really, where you're just wanting to be as close as you can to the action at any given moment. Here's Harold Evans, who was the press secretary to Harold Macmillan. He said, in number 10, as in love, proximity is everything. That and the instinct that takes you to the right place at the right time. So they're constantly concerned about, can you be there for a conversation that matters? So you get... This was told to me by a former Downing Street official. Said this, I was very grateful because my office was right below the private office, so I could pop in a lot, ask the odd question about what else is going on and glean some information. And they sort of described, you know, you can go off to Whitehall, they'll say, what's going on with this? And you're like, you can tell them and your status is enhanced because you're saying something that the Prime Minister, you know, is actually thinking. But they started questioning themselves. They're just like, well, hang on a minute. Like, there's a real problem here. Like, how do I even know this? And they said to me, But to make that something you take satisfaction in is a sign of dysfunction. It means that your effectiveness basically depends on your ability to loiter. And that is how the professional, functional, organizational nature of the building operates. They're just loitering in order to secure their own status.
So is there another building, you know, in the vicinity then, which would just be an obvious alternative? Like, how hard is this? Because when you talk about the problems with the Houses of Parliament and all the renovation that's needed there, and you just go, well, look, I can see why they keep putting it off, because it seems enormously disruptive and expensive. Is there actually a quite simple solution, maybe one of these ones that's been tried out temporarily in the past, where it's just like, there's a much better building over there, and if we could just ditch tradition and precedent, like, it wouldn't cost a lot to change?
Mm, well, I mean, the QE2 for a start.
Right.
You know, the Queen Elizabeth Conference Centre is just right there for the taking. Admittedly, we may want to use that when people leave Parliament for the renovation work, if they ever decide to get their act together and, you know, think about what they're going to do. Or you could take over a government ministry. I mean, I don't want to be too sort of crazy about it. There's no reason why you can't take over the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Those are beautiful offices. If we're going to start looking at a building that has a real sense of grandeur to it, okay, why don't we put Downing Street in there, right? And we'll find another... I mean, the Foreign Office aren't doing anything with it. They seem to be accomplishing absolutely nothing. So why don't they find somewhere else that they go sit? There are options.
Also, they're often not there because they're abroad, aren't they? Exactly. Just, David Cameron just comes back from one of his trips and just like, what are you doing here?
So here's the thing, right? When you see them look so chaotic, kind of all the time, and it's not just, you know, Rishi Sunak or Liz Truss or even Theresa May or Boris Johnson. Jesus Christ, there's been a lot of them. But, you know, even further back, you look at the Brown administration, you just see that, you look at them and you think, it looks really chaotic in there. You know, you guys look like you're really up against it. Part of it is this arrangement. This is how you're making your decisions. You're doing it in this kind of bustle and crowded hallway without any kind of rational structure to adjust for what you're doing. I wanted to end this bit by talking about this one moment where it did work. And it works because instead of following that, someone sits down and follows a system that is much more origin story, which is basically having someone that comes in with a sense of calm and reason, which I think are like values that we'd be rather keen on, but particularly curiosity about the world. And that person's name is Michael Barber. So here's how it usually goes in Westminster. You kind of get like, you got the Prime Minister and he wants to do something, right? So he's like, let's say you want to do one or two things. You want to ban upskirting photos or you want to reduce A&E waiting times, right? To ban upskirting photos is a piece of piss. You just get the department to write the legislation. You pass the legislation because you've got a Commons majority and it's done. Mm. To reduce A&E waiting times is really, really very hard. Like, it takes a lot of organisation to accomplish that. You have to get, you know, you're talking about NHS pay, you're talking about working organisational levels, you're talking about funding to departments, you're talking about cross-departmental communication to measurable targets on an implementable timeframe. It's really difficult to do. So prime ministers therefore love banning things. They fucking love to ban shit because it's such a piece of piss. Mm. It doesn't actually mean that it will happen in the real world or that you fix the problem, but you can tick it off your list.
Sure.
They really struggle with the meaningful stuff. Rishi Sunak gets up there with a sort of 5-point pledge card. Oh, I'm going to reduce NHS waiting times. And so on. You have to put in the work if you're going to accomplish that. You can't just go shouting about the ECHR and Rwanda for a year and then think those waiting times will be done. And this was the same problem, by the way, that Tony Blair had. For a long time, really, for most of the first term was waited. The second term, Michael Barber comes in.
Right.
And he runs something called the Delivery Unit. He'd previously been working in education in the first term, getting really good results on numeracy, literacy, classroom sizes. And he starts going around. He has this sort of principle of just like, I'm interested. I don't want to have the Downing Street macho bullshit. I don't want to go around going, you know, I'm going to kill your mother and wear her face as a mask to your political funeral, rah, rah, rah. I'm actually going to ask you, how is it that things work? Why is it that the trains run very slowly, for instance, in the autumn? To which the Department of Transport said to him was, well, you know, it's because the leaves fall on the lines, like you've heard it. And he was like, well, no, I get that the leaves fall on the lines. What interests me is why that seems to keep on taking you by surprise. Are there any countries that we could learn from, you know, about how they fix the problem of the trains slowing down?
Are there any other countries with leaves in them?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Leaves and trains. Are you aware of any other countries with leaves and trains?
Autumn. Right. Autumn there.
It turns out they're right. I mean, there's Canada. Canada has autumn leaves and trains.
Right.
And they fixed it by chopping down all of their trees because they're Canada. And Poland has the same problem. They fixed it by putting resin on the tracks, which it turned out to be a very good idea and improved autumn journey times as soon as it was implemented. When it came to NHS waiting times, it was about making departments work together. He said to Tony Blair, I ask for 100 hours of your time each year to fit these objectives. The rest of the time, we make this tick along by improving communication with the departments, with the Treasury, taking it out of the number 10 power play asylum and having it according to measurable targets towards an overall aim that acts as a litmus test for the broader health of the service that we are talking about. So let's say it's A&E waiting times. A&E waiting times had a target of 98% wait for 4 hours. 98% of people would be seen in 4 hours at A&E. Why? Not because it was this fantastic consumer experience, but because if you're getting people off A&E, it means that you're getting them onto the wards. And if you're getting them onto the wards, it means that you're getting them into social care. And if all of that's happening, it means that the ambulances are able to pick people up and not just waiting 8 hours before they can discharge patients at A&E so they can get to the next patient. It was a litmus test for broader health. By having that kind of empirical, quite unemotional, unmacho approach to things, we finally got results. We didn't get a lot of results in the first term of Blair, and by the third term of Blair, it just turned into that insane, into Nissine Brown Blair feud bloodbath. But the second term, when everyone else was talking about Iraq and September the 11th, we got results. And we got it by a complete rejection of the chaotic, macho horseshit that is typified by the architecture of that building, and by actually thinking in a much more modern, academic, rational way about the problems that we faced and how to fix them. So the funny thing is, you look at the madness of the house, but there are moments where you see systems that worked and we could learn from them if we chose to.
Hello. I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, we started off doing Origin Story with big ideas, and then we managed to do ideas through people. And this is the first time we've done one about a building.
Ooh. Maybe instead of this being my incredibly tenuous act of editorial promotion, this could actually be the beginning of a rich new seam of endeavour for us.
And hit book, 10 Buildings That Changed the World.
I mean, that would sell quite... That book must have been written.
That must have been written, right?
Because that's a good title. That if not, good. You should write that in your fucking notebook, because that could work.
I can stop writing them down now. Please send in your building ideas. Baby needs a new pair of shoes. So many of you, I'm sure, will have already got a copy of Ian's book, How Westminster Works. In fact, some Patreon backers may have signed hardbacks. If not, it is out now in paperback.
Yes, that if you sign up at a certain level on Patreon, we sign a copy of our books and we send it out to you with a message of your choice. I'm a bit disappointed so far that none of the messages have been filthy or imaginative. They've mostly been quite pleasant. So for the next people that sign up at that tier level, please come up with something really quite despicable for us to write in those books.
You will also get bonus between season episodes. You get the actual season episodes a week early. Season 5 is starting in early May. You get reduced tickets to the live show. The next one, as you mentioned, 7th of May in London. And just lots of... And you basically make us happy. And you enable us to read all these books and prepare to spend time with each other, to be honest.
I love the way that you got to the end of that list of things that you get as a patron and ended with, you get to make us happy.
Right. And maybe I should have started with that as opposed to being quite so transactional. I should be speaking more to emotion rather than like just financial self-interest. Thank you so much. We will see you very soon.
See you guys.